Welcome to The Creationist, a podcast about people who create. I'm your host, Steve Waxman. Tim Summers had a remarkable life in the music industry. He became a rock journalist at the age of 16, writing for Trouser Press, and then as the New York correspondent for Sounds magazine in the UK. He was the first American journalist to interview U2, and Henry Rollins even called him out by name in print for a bad review Tim once wrote. He hosted an influential hardcore punk rock radio show on WNYU, and then he learned how to play bass and became a recording artist in the art rock band Hugo Largo, working with Michael Stipe and Brian Eno. He's worked at MTV, and in the mid-90s he became, given his background, perhaps the most unlikely of A&R people to sign Hootie and the Blowfish.
Sometimes people would say to me, well, you were a genius for signing the Hootie and the Blowfish. And I said, no, I would have been an idiot to sit in a club and hear a band play Let Her Cry and not sign them. And despite the fact that in 1993, the music industry, as I explained in the book, was all grunge all the time. And that's why no one was signing Hootie and the Blowfish. No one was signing Dave Matthews' band. No one was signing bands like that, except for one person would go out and say, like, Bruce Floor at RCA and myself at Atlantic said, I'm taking a chance in this group. Regardless of that, who sits in a club, much less a club full of people, packed with people, who sits in a club and hears a band play Let Her Cry and doesn't sign that band?
After a 30-year break, Tim returned to music journalism in 2013, writing music and culture essays for a number of web publications. With the release of Only Want to Be With You, the inside story of Hootie and the Blowfish, Tim can now add author to his resume. His background and relationship with the band made him uniquely qualified to write this book. Here's some of what I learned after reading it. Before they ever had a record deal, Hootie and the Blowfish were making close to $1 million a year as a cover band. If they could have been any other band in the world, they would have been REM. Once signed to Atlantic, they were victimized by label politics. Their 25th anniversary tour in 2019 was more lucrative than when the band was in their heyday. And Darius Rucker finally speaks out about his experience as a black man in America. This is a music biography unlike any I've ever read before, as Tim is able to write from the perspective of an outsider, as well as an insider and a music historian. After reading his book, I told Tim that it could have been subtitled, How to Make It in the Music Business and Not Die Trying. The first time I heard the name Hootie and the Blowfish was over a dinner I shared with Tim in Toronto a few months before the release of the band's major label debut, Cracked Rear View. He had recently signed the band to Atlantic Records, and he explained that almost no one at the label believed in Hootie. And then he laid out for me the plan of how the record was going to break. And it did, big time, just like he said. If you're interested in insider stories, you'll really dig this one. And stick around for Tim's thoughts on the responsibility of music journalism from lessons that he learned from his own experiences. Oh yeah, one more thing. This one's pretty personal to me, because you see, Tim and I were college roommates at NYU, and bandmates and even worse. Let's start with, when did you start thinking about writing a book about Hootie and the Blowfish?
Probably in 2018, around then. An agent named Rick Richter from the Avidus agency approached me and said, Tim, I like your writing. We should talk about books for you to do, book subjects for you to do. And oddly, although I'd always dreamed of writing a book, nothing popped instantly to me. Nothing jumped out at me and said, there were a lot of things that I had strong opinions about. There were a lot of things that I thought would make good books. But what you or I want to think will make a good book is not necessarily a book that you can sell to someone. Maybe it'll make a good article. Maybe it would make a good long article. Maybe it would make a good discussion to have in a bar. But it wouldn't necessarily make a good book in terms of something that a publisher would spend money for, in terms of something that a buyer at Barnes & Noble or at Amazon would spend money for. So we spent a long time, maybe up to a year, tossing around different ideas. And then, I guess in early 2019, it became clear that Hootie and the Blowfish were gearing up for a big year in 2019. It was the 25th anniversary of Cracked Rear View. and Hootie and the Blowfish, after having not had any real activity since 2008, 2006, were gearing up for a big tour. And it was turning out to be a much bigger tour than a lot of people, including a lot of the people who deride Hootie and the Blowfish, thought it was going to be. And as it geared up, the 2019, the 25th anniversary of the release of Hootie and the Blowfish's debut, Cracked Review, was going to be a big year. Rick and I said, maybe you should write a book about Hootie and the Blowfish. Obviously, if someone is going to write a book about Hootie and the Blowfish, it should be you. You're an experienced journalist, and you were there. You signed the band to Atlantic Records. You spent those key years with them, sort of by their sides almost constantly between, I was by their side almost constantly between 1993 and 1998. You're the person to write this book. So Rick said, let's do this. Let's think about writing a book about Hootie and the Blowfish. So I almost immediately called all four band members separately. I got Darius on the phone. I got Dean on the phone. I got Mark on the phone. I got Sony on the phone. I said, what do you think about me doing this? Because I won't do this without you giving your consent and your cooperation. And all of them said yes. All of them said, you're the person to do this. If anyone's going to write a book about it, us, you're the person. So at that point, we put together a book pitch and we sold the book to, I think we had a bunch of people who were interested, but then University of South Carolina Press, the publisher, aligned to the university where all four members of Hootie and the Blowfish had went and where the band was formed out of. They came forward and they said they wanted to do it, and it seemed like a natural fit. So I guess in an ideal world, we would have had the book out in time for the tour and for the album that came out subsequent to that in the fall of 2019, but that didn't happen. The book didn't come out till 2021. Till April 2021, but that was okay. What I think 2019 revealed was that Cracked Review was a very important record to a lot of people, and it meant a lot to a lot of people. And just by being part of their Facebook groups and being part of monitoring their social presence, their online presence and their social media presence, a lot of people, you know, Cracked Review was a soundtrack to a certain part of their lives. So it became apparent that even coming out a little later than we'd like it to, that this book was going to have an audience.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the how. Is that the why? Not necessarily. The why was, I thought Hootie and the Blowfish had a story that represented a very, very common story to me. This is something I say repeatedly in the book. And if you or anyone asked me why I did this, not how I did it, the answer is I wrote this book for the same reason that I signed Hootie and the Blowfish. I knew these people. These people were very familiar to me. Hootie and the Blowfish instantly felt like friends. And because they felt like friends, I sort of understood why they formed a band. And Steve, as you pointed out in your personal communications to me, this isn't just a book about Hootie and the Blowfish. Though a Hootie and the Blowfish fan will get everything they want out of this book. They will get all of the inside information. They will get all of the anecdotes. So for a fan of Hootie and the Blowfish, they will be very satisfied with this book. I wrote this for the fans of Hootie and the Blowfish, but I also wrote it for people like you and I. I wanted to tell the story of people born and shaped by Generation REM, Generation College Rock, by all the people who were a little bit outsiders, not weirdos with a capital W, but people who grew up a little bit outside, people who alternative music and college radio really shaped them. And those people coming together to form a band in the 1980s or 1990s, and that's Hootie and the Blowfish. Because it's important to remember that Hootie and the Blowfish, although they didn't emerge in the public eye until 1994 and 1995, they formed their band. They met 1983, 84, and 85, and they formed their band in 1985. So they were Generation REM. These were people, and this came up again and again. And Steve, you know how important REM were to me, and you were fortunate enough to work with REM in your capacity as a publicist. REM, Hootie and the Blowfish would not have existed without REM, which is true of so many bands. It's true of Nirvana. It's true of Radiohead. It's true of so many bands who came together in the late 1980s and mid-1980s and early 1990s. These were bands that were shaped. I've often said that REM to America, and I'm going to include North America in that. I'm going to say to the United States and Canada, Hootie and the Blowfish did what the Sex Pistols did in England. They brought together all these different tribes. In 1976, the Sex Pistols became the spot where all of the fans of pub rock and glam rock and weird rock and rock that included transsexual people, all of the Rocky Horror fans and all the David Bowie fans and all the Dr. Feelgood fans and all the Krautrock fans and all the Hawkwind fans came together in one place behind the Sex Pistols. Now, all of these same people didn't have the Sex Pistols in America. In 1979, all of the alternative music tribes in America were disparate, were all over the place. Steve, when I met you and I said, Steve, look at all these records you have. What is their common factor? You remember what you told me?
Oh, God, I don't remember that far back. I'm glad that you do.
I'll always remember this, Steve. I said, Steve.
Oh, wait a second. Is this the keyboard thing?
Yes. Yes.
That none of them have keyboards on them. I hate keyboards.
I said, Steve, how did you decide what kind of records you were going to buy? This is before there was MTV. This is before there was alternative radio. This is before when there was just a few. If you wanted to, in 1979, if you wanted to find out about alternative music in North America, you had to go find the NME and you had to find Sounds and Melody Maker. And you went through every page saying, what should I buy? What should I buy? And it was all over the place. It was these disparate tribes. And you said, oh, well, if a record didn't have a keyboardist, I was willing to take a chance on it. And because of that, you found a lot of interesting things. Now, what I'm getting at here is the Sex Pistols and punk rock in England brought together these disparate tribes. It's easy to say, oh, in the United States, Ramones did that, but they didn't. Talking Heads did that, but they didn't. Television did that, but they didn't. Blondie did that, but they didn't. You still had all of these people all over America. In 1982, in 1984, they coalesced around REM. All of these tribes. And these are the people who formed Hootie and the Blowfish. These are the people who formed probably Canadian bands. Like, I want to say probably, you know, Bare Naked Ladies probably came together because of something like REM. In England, Radiohead. And in the United States, Nirvana. Kurt Cobain was alive. He'd tell you the same thing. I am Generation REM. I am Generation REM. And Hootie and the Blowfish were Generation REM. On the first night, and this is all in the book, on the first night that I saw Hootie and the Blowfish in August or September, I can't remember. I should have looked at the book before doing this. The first night that I saw Hootie and the Blowfish in Charleston, South Carolina in August of 1993, I instantly recognized them as people who were born and raised listening to REM, who were doing what they were doing because of REM. That's why I signed Hootie and the Blowfish. And I feel to a degree, it's why I wrote the book. Very long answer, I'm sorry.
Well done, though. Well done. So I am curious, though. this book is really written in, you've written it in three different voices, which is really interesting. And I want to get into that. But first, I'm just curious, when you decided that this is the book you wanted to write, and after you spoke to the four band members, did you immediately start forming in your head a form for what this book was going to be, or the voice that you were going to speak in, given that you are in the middle of the story as well?
It's interesting. The pitch I wrote for the book is, you know, when you have to do pitches, you have to do sample chapters. And the sample chapter I wrote was very much in the first person. Once I had done that, I realized that wasn't the way, the book wasn't to tell my story. My story was only going to be part of the book in so much as it impacted Hootie and the Blowfish. So my story is in there. There were times where my insight, my presence at events was inseparable from the way those events unfolded. And that's where I put myself into it. Other than that, I tried not to make it my story. There's something that's in this book that I think if someone was interested in the way record companies work and the way that bands are put together and the way that bands are unfolded, there's a very important, I won't say a lesson, I'll say story. There's a very important story in this book about the fact that a band is the tip of the iceberg. They may not even be the top of the iceberg. That every band, even bands who are playing locally, even bands, they never get past a tiny club. Bands are never the four people on stage. Bands are their drummer who formed the band and then left before they ever played a gig. Bands are the girlfriend who drove them to rehearsals and who broke up with the bass player before they even played a gig. Bands are the mother of the manager who went to jail and left him the trailer that he lived in. Bands are these enormous octopus organizations where you just see the guys on stage. That's another big part of the Hootie and the Blowfish story. And you asked me, so when I started writing this, my story is only in there in so much as it impacts events. But the very first thing I did, Steve, when I started writing this book, is I reached out to all those tendrils of the octopus. I reached out to the person who recorded their first demo. I reached out to the person who was involved in, there's a record deal. They were offered a major record label deal by a new label called JRS Records in 1991. It's a record deal that vanished, but it shaped them that it vanished. It shaped them that the label got rid of them before they ever recorded a note. That built this band. Bands are built by a million outside events. I wanted to tell that story too. So the story that's in this book is a million smaller characters. So for instance, specific to the Hootie and the Blowfish story and specific to this book, Only Want to Be With You, the inside story of Hootie and the Blowfish, specific to that is I wanted to tell the story of Brantley Smith. Brantley Smith was Hootie and the Blowfish's first drummer. He was in the band from 1985 to 1989 when he decided that being in a band was incompatible with his faith, that he was a person who his first and foremost relationship was a relationship he had with Jesus. And I say that with enormous respect. And he decided, despite the fact that he loved Hootie and the Blowfish, and Hootie and the Blowfish loved him, and despite the fact that every member of Hootie and the Blowfish and every person who saw Hootie and the Blowfish during the years Brantley Smith was in the band will say, Hootie and the Blowfish comes right out and says this. Darius and Dean and Mark will come out right out and say this, that Brantley Smith was the best musician who was ever in the band. I wanted to tell his story because he decided one day in 1989, he decided, hey, this band is going places, but that may be incompatible with my belief in Jesus and the life I want to live as a man of faith. So he left the band and he was replaced by Sonny Sonnefeld. And Gene Sonnefeld came in And Jim Sonnenfeld comes into this band, and Jim Sonnenfeld tells this great story. I find out I'm an audition for Hootie and the Blowfish, he says. And they hand me a tape with 12 REM songs on this. And they say, learn these 12 REM songs. We'll meet you at a rehearsal. And Jim shows up at this rehearsal and he says, okay, I learned your 12 REM songs, but I'm not joining this band unless you play original songs. And he sits down with them and he says, I have a song. And if you play this song and learn this song, I'll consider joining your band. And the song is Hold My Hand, which becomes a signature Hootie and the Blowfish song. So bands are, this is another thing, Steve, this is something you'll really identify with. And I want people to understand this if they are interested in buying this book. Every single band, including the worst band that you've never heard of, has an interesting story. Every single band has an interesting story. Every single band has a complicated story. Not just the bands that become famous. So the fact that Hootie and the Blowfish have this wonderful drummer during their cover band era who leaves because he wants to honor his faith, that's an interesting story. The fact that they have this other drummer who comes in and says, hey, I'll be in your band that is becoming a very popular local cover band, but we have to play original songs. Every band has a story that's that interesting. So I wanted to meet or talk to all of these people and tell their stories as well and have it all add up to be, hey, listen, America, North America, the world, whoever the hell reads this book, I want you to know how bands come together. I want you to know the sacrifices people make to be in bands, the lives that they choose to be in bands, and what an octopus of an organization it is to be in a little band or to be in a successful band. Now, what's interesting about Hootie and the Blowfish, it'll make lots of sense to you as someone who's been on both sides, Steve, is Hootie and the Blowfish were made by that octopus, meaning it's a sacrifice and hard work of people like Rusty Harmon and Dick Hodgen. Dick Hodgen was their first producer. It was Rusty's first partner. It's these hard work that makes a band. It's also the errors and the weaknesses of that organization that bring down a band. I have no hesitation in saying that. And Rusty will tell you the same thing, that Rusty's, the mistakes he made as a manager, his inability to see problems coming, his arrogance, his drunkenness, whatever, that brought down Hootie and the Blowfish too in the late 90s. So every band has this fascinating story. Likewise, I wanted to tell a record company story. For instance, I wanted to shine some light on a guy named Scott Schiff. Scott Schiff is the person who put his ass on the line when he got a demo tape in 1993. He put his ass on the line to make sure Danny Goldberg on the West Coast would get it. And Danny Goldberg is the person who gave it to me. I'm not the person who Hootie and the Blowfish didn't come in the mail and land on my desk. It landed on this guy Scott Schiff's desk in New York. And Scott Schiff's story had never been told. I wanted to tell his story. I wanted to tell the story of Kim Kyman, the product manager at Atlantic Records, who more than any one person is responsible for the success of Hootie and the Blowfish. And the fact is, it's when people like Scott, like Kim Kyman, myself, when we begin to exit, Jim Lawrence, a publicist who also left Atlantic around 1996, as people like Kim Kyman and myself and Jim Lawrence exit the story in 1996, 97, 98, that's when Hootie begins to sink at Atlantic Records, because ultimately, I can't speak for the way record labels are now. They're so different now. As record labels don't give a damn about bands. The people at record labels give a damn about bands. Steve Waxman caring about a band is the reason that a band maybe at Warner Brothers succeeded. Warner Brothers, the animal, WEA, the animal, Atlantic Records, the animal, is not what makes a band. It's the people at record labels saying, you've got to pay attention to this. Caring about the people in bands, that's what makes a band succeed. And I hope, I think I tell that story. I'll tell you what, I just blabbed for about 20 minutes. And I think I explained really well, in a way that I've never even explained it to myself, why this book was important to me and why it may be important to anyone who cares about the record industry in the 1990s. There may have been, there may have been a time record labels cared about bands. I don't think that's ever, this golden age never existed. The golden age where record labels cared about bands never existed. However, there may have been a time when one or two or three people at a record label caring about a band could make a difference between that band vanishing and that band succeeding. Steve, I'm sure in your personal experience, and I don't know the names of these bands, and I apologize, there must be bands that Steve Waxman, caring about these bands, made that band succeed. And maybe it wasn't even that the band was the best music in the world or music that you loved. Maybe you just believed in them as people. But I'm sure that there's a band, or more than a band, that Steve Waxman, caring about that band, made that band succeed.
One of the things about this book, obviously there's a lot of people, as you say, you know, that have derided Hootie and the Blowfish over the years. And I don't think, you know, and I spoke to a friend of mine earlier today when I was telling him about our conversation that we were going to have this afternoon, who, of course, is one of those people that, you know, loves REM but hated Hootie and the Blowfish. And when I started to tell him the story, especially the part of the story where they were hugely successful as a cover band that did some original materials, hugely successful. They did not need the record deal. They probably would have survived longer without it.
I think I calculated that in 2020 money, they were making $900,000 a year. They were making $1 million a year.
Yeah. So the thing that I think that people need to understand and realize is, as a band like Hootie and the Blowfish, as successful as they were as a cover band, would not have been successful as a recording artist if they didn't write great songs. So regardless of what you might think of their music, you can't deny how great the songs were, because they would not have been successful just because of the work that you did in America, that Scott did bringing to people's attention, that Kim did as a product manager, or that the team up here in Canada did, without those songs being great.
That's exactly right. There was always this myth about the record industry, at least in the 1990s, and I'm sure in the 1980s and 70s and 60s as well. People used to say, well, if a record company gets behind something, and they can make anything a hit. And that simply wasn't true. You needed the song. And sometimes people would say to me, well, you were a genius for signing in the Hootie and the Blowfish. And I said, no, I would have been an idiot to sit in a club and hear a band play Let Her Cry and not sign them. And despite the fact that in 1993, the music industry, as I explained in the book, was all grunge all the time. And that's why no one was signing Hootie and the Blowfish. No one was signing Dave Matthews Band. No one was signing bands like that, except for one person would go out and say, like Bruce Flohr at RCA and myself at Atlantic said, I'm taking a chance in this group. Regardless of that, who sits in a club, much less a club full of people, packed with people, who sits in a club and hears a band play Let Her Cry and doesn't sign that band? That would be bad A&R, you know? It's interesting because, speaking of Canada, it's all of one piece. In, as you know, starting about 1991, 92, the record industry became, from an A&R point of view, from a record company point of view, became all grunge all the time. I say in the book that you could be a rumor. You could have formed a band a week ago in Seattle, and if you had a Tad sticker, if you had the right clothes and a TAD sticker on your guitar case, you could have gotten signed, and that's not an exaggeration. However, there was something else happening. And in a weird way, it begins with Alanis Morissette and begins with Sheryl Crow. It begins with these people who are doing something that's a little bit outside of what grunge is. And then it becomes Hootie and the Blowfish and Cher and Dave Matthews Band and expands out from there, where this becomes this industry. And I sometimes wonder, if I was telling this story, looking back, I was going to say 20, 25 years later, it is 20, 25 years later. I wonder if the whole movement doesn't really start with Alanis and Sheryl Crow. The whole movement that then, the whole anti-grunge movement, it's not anti-grunge movement, but this thing that's an alternative to the all grunge all the time movement. But again, you said it starts with the songs. Yes, it starts with the songs. It doesn't happen without the songs. I just told you, you're an idiot if you don't sign a band that plays Let Her Cry. And other people, there's another time where people said, oh, Tim, I heard this a lot in the 90s. Tim, you're a genius for signing Hootie and the Blowfish. I said, no, I'm a genius for not signing Johnny Quest. Johnny Quest were a band who were also on the exact same circuit in South Carolina as Hootie and the Blowfish, and who did the same numbers. Likewise, they were playing Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday in the whole Carolina, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, Upper Georgia, Upper Alabama, that whole circuit. The whole circuit that Hootie and the Blowfish were doing, Johnny Quest were doing the same circuit and doing the same numbers. Those numbers being 800 to 2,000 a night. People, not money. Money, they were doing much more than that. They were doing $5,000 to $10,000 a night, $12,000 a night. So Johnny Quest were doing the same circuit as Hootie and the Blowfish, doing the exact same numbers, but they didn't have the songs. Johnny Quest were essentially a Red Hot Chili Peppers, Beastie Boys type fan band who were driving audiences crazy, just like Hootie and the Blowfish, but they didn't have the songs. So anyone going to South Carolina would have said, oh, look, Tim, these people are doing the same numbers and getting the same audience reaction as Hootie and the Blowfish. Why aren't you signing them? Because they don't have the songs. Yeah. So like you said, it all goes back to the songs.
Yeah. But I don't want to make this, I don't want to make this strictly a conversation about A&R. I want to get back to you as a writer. And I want to, continue on with this book. I've read a lot of music biographies. I think, you know, you've probably read many more than I have. I want to get back to how unique this book is because of your background as a rock journalist, but you also have the background of being a recording artist, and you have you're in the middle of this story. So there's no ghostwriter here, and this. You are the ghostwriter of your own story. So it's really interesting to me, as I said at the beginning, about how you are able to write this from first person, second person, and third person throughout. And it's unlike, as far as I know, unless you can tell me differently, it's unlike any other music biography that's out there.
Thank you for saying that. And I think you may be right. I wanted to tell the story of this story of a band forming, and I had been in bands that had formed, so I knew what that feeling was like. I wanted to tell the story of a band forming, experiencing what it means to be in a band, experiencing what it means to be signed by a major label, experiencing what it means to be in a recording studio. And it's interesting. Maybe you can tell that story better if you've sat in a recording studio and had to do hours of bass overdubs or bass fixes. You have to understand how utterly unglamorous it is to be in a band, to write a band biography correctly. You have to understand that one of the things that made Hootie and the Blowfish completely, largely unique, I don't know another story like this, is that after, what is it now, 20, you know, they got together the first time in 1985. So that's 37 years ago, is that right?
I think so.
They're still friends. They really like each other. And, you know, I don't know. I can't remember if this is in the book or not. I think it is. You know, someone asked me, oh, you know, well, they must have, in 2019, when they went back on the road, they must have did it for money. I mean, after all, they were grossing over $1 million a night. Because that's a peculiar thing. Their 2019 reunion tour, which wasn't a reunion, the 2019 anniversary tour, they were making, even adjusted from 1996 dollars, even when you adjusted the dollars, they were making more in 2019 than they were in 1996, even when the money was adjusted. And so people ask me, did they do this for the money? And I said, no, they did this because they want to look over on stage and see their friends again. To understand what it means to still be friends with someone after being in a band with them for 30 years, I think it was important to understand how unique that was. Here were four guys who were still each other's best friends, despite the fact that one of them had married another one's wife. Yeah, and they were still friends. You know, it's just totally weird. So my unique experience as a journalist, as a record company guy, as a musician, the fact that I had done all these things helped me understand what a strange thing it is to be in a band. How boring it is. If I, for instance, if I were to sit down and give myself advice, wish I'd given myself advice when I was in a working band in my late 20s, my mid and late 20s. If I could give myself advice, if I could give any band advice, I would say, recognize what a wonderful job this is. This is a job, and deal with all of these problems the way you would deal with these problems if you were in a job situation. People treat being in a band far, far too preciously. They go, oh, they're angry at me that I'm a vegetarian and they're a meat eater. I'm leaving. You know, this person doesn't like my girlfriend. I'm leaving. Would you do that if you were working in an office? If you had this great job you loved in an office, would you leave because someone didn't like your girlfriend? You know, people have to learn to treat, if a band is going to succeed, you have to treat it, recognize what a wonderful, wonderful job it is. Now, I feel Hootie and the Blowfish realized this about being in a band, maybe because they were a working band for 8 years before they were signed. So maybe they realized they had this wonderful organization, this working organization together, even before they were signed. So I think maybe that's something I write about in the book. I write about the fact that they, A, are friends. B, they always treated it as a job. In the book, their lawyer, Gus Kussler, tells a wonderful story about how Gus had some experience working with bands. He decided he was never going to work with a band again when Hootie and the Blowfish met with him for the first time in 1992 or 91. And he decided he was never going to work with a band again. Hootie and the Blowfish have a meeting with him, and Dean says, well, we want to figure out how to get health insurance, and we want to figure out how to take out insurance on the van. And Gus said he'd never been with a band that sat with him, and that was the first thing they said. Band always sit with him, and they say, oh, how do you get us a record deal? Hootie and Blowfish didn't say that the first meeting with them. The first words out of their mouth was, well, we want to figure out how to incorporate so we can get better insurance, get health insurance for all of us and all the people who work for us, and get insurance on our van. And that's when Gus decided to work with them. Now, you go into a band with that attitude, that band has a much better chance of staying together for 20 or 30 years. Does that make any sense? Yep. Now, maybe the reason I went on about that and tell that story is, I think that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. That's another part of the story I wanted to tell. I wanted to tell a story about how being in a band is 0.1% the funny or sexy story that happens in the tour bus. The rest of it is all this other stuff. And for a band to succeed, it has to be an appreciation of this other stuff. That's a story I wanted to tell. And maybe because I had been in a band, maybe because I worked for a record company, maybe because I had been a journalist from the age of 16 and hanging around bands since 15, 16 years old, maybe I understood that only 0.1% is the sexy stuff.
Well, look, you've touched on so many things that this book is about already, and we haven't talked about one thing that this book is also about that is something that was rarely, if ever, talked about, and that's race. And Darius, as a black man playing for predominantly white audiences, a genre of music that is perceived as a white genre of music. And I just wrote a phrase down here, something that became a real pressure point a couple of years ago, because I think now in retrospect I think about it with regards to Darius, Hootie and the Blowfish, and their audience, and that phrase is, "I don't see color," and we never realized how offensive that is.
Exactly, brilliantly put. That's brilliantly put. And I think I say this in the book. I can't remember if it's something I said in the book or something I just thought. Hootie and the Blowfish came of age in the American public eye in the mid-90s during the age of Bill Clinton. And I feel, I don't see color. And it was a very popular phrase back then. I feel that we had this false idea in the 1990s that we were past it. And of course, that was utter and complete crap. I used to see Darius. I remember I would go see them on the road and see them play in front of 18,000 people. And I would think to myself, the man standing on stage here is the only person of color in this entire room. Why aren't we talking about it? And I didn't talk about it. It was time for people to start talking about that. So Hootie and the Blowfish come of age in this feel-good Clinton era when we don't talk about these things, when we think we're past it. By the time they do their 25th anniversary tour in 2019, in the time I write this book, it's an entirely different story. We realize that the United States is far from being past the color issue, that the color issue is more central than ever. And not just because of whatever you want to say about Black Lives Matter or whatever, just because that stain is always with America. I will be very honest with you in a way that I was not honest in the book and say that, actually, let me change that. It's easy for me as a white person to say that maybe Darius Rucker has not done enough. I wish Darius Rucker was more political. I wish Darius Rucker took more stands. I feel him and his management are terrified of him taking stands. They're afraid of him alienating parts of his audience. Now, that's me as a white American talking. A Black American might say something very, very different. And this goes to something that I deal with in the book. In the book, I have a quote, a couple of quotes from African-American writers and African-American fans of Darius Rucker and Hootie and the Blowfish, who say the following: just Darius Rucker being up there is making a statement. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? And they explained something to me. If you lived in the South in the 1960s and you didn't, just walking down the sidewalk as an African-American and not stepping into the street when a white person walked by, was making a statement. For Darius Rucker to be an African-American playing country music, to be one of only three African-Americans in inducted as an official member of the Grand Ole Opry in the entire history of that organization, in the 97-year history of that organization, for Darius Rucker to be the first African-American since 1967 to have had a prominent country career, just doing that makes a statement, is what they told me, what they explained to me. Darius Rucker doesn't have to be manning the barricades. He is manning the barricades just by making his presence known. An African-American writer explained to me that for people of color to be able to turn on the TV and see Darius Rucker singing country music will inspire a future generation to think, that is something I can do. And that is making a statement. So yeah, I get disappointed that Darius Rucker doesn't do more, doesn't take more of a stand, doesn't make more of his presence known. But that's easy for me to say as a white American. The story of Hootie and the Blowfish is inseparable, and the story of Darius Rucker is inseparable from the story of race. And I think it's important to understand that Darius Rucker isn't an African-American from some Northeast suburb who went to an Ivy League school. Darius Rucker is from inner city Charleston. Darius Rucker is from a single parent African-American lower income family. That experience is in everything he does. He tells a story in the book of something that happened to him in Nashville in 2020, where everyone's masked up because of the pandemic, and he's in an Apple store and he doesn't get served because he's an African-American. Now, he lowers that mask and everyone sees he's Darius Rucker and they'll all be rushing to serve. But without lowering that mask, he doesn't get served. One of the days that I did my interviews with Darius, he was in a mood to talk about this, which he rarely does. I don't think he doesn't talk about race very much. I can't make a judgment that Darius Rucker doesn't talk about race. I can't make that judgment that he doesn't take a stand enough. He takes a stand just by being who he is. And because of that, maybe I don't feel qualified to talk about Hootie and the Blowfish and race, other to say that it's a huge part of their story. They represent, to quote someone in the book, Sarah Rodman, I believe her name is. They represent just by being, in the same sense that just taking a seat on a bus in 1957 for an African American made a huge statement. Just by taking a seat at the table of country music, Darius Rucker made a huge statement. And I think I do deal with that in the book. There's a whole chapter about it. Did that answer that question at all?
No, absolutely. The other part of it that I found fascinating, not only did you not talk to him about it in those days back then, but apparently the other band members didn't realize what he was going through as well as a black man, which is fascinating given that they were such close friends.
I can't remember if this is in the book or not. I know it's came up with all of the band members in the interviews I did with them. Darius doesn't talk about it. Darius doesn't talk about race. They don't sit and talk to Darius Rucker about what it means to be black and doing what he does. Yeah, they don't talk about it. They're his best friends, and they don't talk about it.
I'd like to talk, let's tell a little bit about your backstory. It's just so great that you, as a teenager, decided that you were going to be a rock journalist. Why don't you share the story with us?
I don't think, like so many people who decide to act or to be a filmmaker or to play music, I didn't feel it was anything weird. I didn't feel like I had a choice. It didn't even feel like I was doing anything oppositional. I was fascinated by music. I was fascinated by the idea of writing about music. I wrote about music for my high school newspaper, and I thought it was natural to me to think, this is what I want to do. It didn't seem like anything weird to me. So when I was 16 years old, I think I was still 15 actually, I called up Trouser Press magazine, which was my favorite magazine, and I called and I said, "Do you need an office boy?" And Ira Robbins happened to answer the phone, which was unusual. Usually it would be his assistant, Louise, who would answer the phone. Ira Robbins answered the phone. If Louise had answered the phone, she would have said no. And that would have been the end of that story. And I would have had a very different life. Ira Robbins answered the phone. He said, "Yeah, sure, come on in." So I went in, and instantly these guys felt like my brothers, my older brothers, because when you're 16, the difference between 16 and 25 is enormous. So these guys felt like my older brothers. They liked me. They said, and it felt like diving into everything that I wanted to be a part of. It felt like diving into this magical place, New York City, and this magical world, rock and roll. And they gave me a chance to write. And when you met me in 1979, 1980, I was already writing. In fact, my journalist career, when I was 18 years old, was healthier than it ever was. It was the healthiest it was ever going to be.
Right.
I was doing more writing when I was 18 and making more money from it than I was ever going to make again as a writer. For some reason, I was a very in-demand writer when I was 18 years old. I don't know why now. Well, I know a little bit. My opinions were a little bit outside. They were not the common music critic opinions, especially in New York. What I think it's important to stress is none of this stuff seemed unusual to me. This didn't seem like, oh, I am going to do this. I'm going to dress funny and do this. I'm going to write about punk rock. It was like, yeah, well, of course I'm going to write about punk rock. That's what I want to do. It felt very natural to me. And when you met me, it felt very natural to me that I was writing about music. And I wanted to write about the music that I liked. I didn't want to write about the music that other people liked. I wanted to write about the music that I liked. Which was punk rock, which was English music, which was outsider English music. Even bands like, I remember, and this would have exactly coincided to the time when you and I were first associating. I saw U2, and I heard U2's first record on a pre-release, I think it was. Or you know what it was? It was Arthur Brenner played me their first singles on Irish CBS. And I thought, this is really interesting. I want to write about this band. And instantly I wanted to write about U2, and I became the first American to interview U2 on December 6, 1980. And I had a sense that U2 were going to become huge, but that's not why I wrote about them. I wrote about them because they were an interesting new British band. So it seemed natural to me to write about music. And then in 1984, I think on the recommendation of our friend Thurston Moore, I became a member of the Glenn Branca Ensemble. And Glenn was making very strange music that didn't sound strange to me. It sounded natural to me. So I became a part of that. And almost as soon as I started being a musician, and then almost immediately after that formed my own band, Hugo Largo, that didn't seem unusual to me. What was unusual to other people felt natural to me. And it didn't feel like I was putting on the Mr. Unusual cap. It didn't feel, and I think you understood this about me, it didn't feel like I was doing something just to be weird. It felt all felt very, very natural to me. So my background was first as a teenage journalist, then in my early and mid-20s and late-20s as a musician. And then somewhere along the way, I hooked up with MTV because when I wasn't working as a musician, I was working at MTV in the early days of MTV. That also felt natural to me. MTV, in some ways, was analogous to the Hootie and the Blowfish experience in so much as MTV, and I worked at MTV on and off between late 1983 until early 1992. I worked on and off for MTV networks when I wasn't playing in a band. MTV felt like the best people in the world and the most fun I ever had at a job. They were just great people. And that's what I remember about the MTV experience. So all of these things felt very natural to me. Just the same as signing Hootie and the Blowfish seemed like a gimme to me. It wasn't something I did because I felt they'd be famous. It was something I did because I wanted to do it. Does that make any sense?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. So I want to kind of wind this down, but I am really curious because I have known you a really long time, and I do know that, you know, the music that you like, have always liked, is not necessarily the music that other people have liked, though you have liked.
I would say that's true, yeah.
But over the past few years, you've been doing a lot of really, really colorful writing. Is it Rock and Roll Globe?
Yeah, that's right.
Rock and Roll Globe. And what I've...
Rock and Roll Globe. And before that, the New York Observer and Inside Hook. They let me write whatever I wanted.
Right.
And especially the Brooklyn Bugle, which was John Laskowski's site, mm-hmm. which is where I started when I got back into writing in 2013, after essentially a 30-year hiatus from writing. They let me write about anything I wanted in using any tone I wanted.
Which is fantastic, because I think that's the point that I wanted to get to is... There is a lot of, and I have found this so amusing, there is so much writing of appreciation for music that I know you hated back when we were friends in 1980. And I find it really fascinating that you've gone back to things like Boston, that you've gone back to things, well, I mean, I was always into hard rock and metal, and you've gone back to, you know, an appreciation of things like Judas Priest. And frankly, I did not know about your long-winded love for Hawkwind, but just the things that you've written about that back in 1980, 81, when we were roommates, we were close friends, you would not have touched with a 10-foot pole.
And I think that's natural. That's unfortunate, but natural. I think when you're young, you find your tribe, and your tribe means putting up certain flags. And that unfortunately means excluding certain things. So therefore, because I excluded certain things, and one of the things that I think I excluded as a matter of rote, just as a rule, was anything that was playing in arenas or stadiums. I thought, I will be extremely diverse with what I like on the club level, which is why I like things from Sonic Youth to The Fall, to really quiet things, really loud things. When it came to music that wasn't on the radio and played at a club level, I was very diverse. But there was something about my taste between the ages of 14 and, let's say, age 30. There was something about my taste that said, that just excluded anything that was on a stadium or arena level. I remember at WMYU, which was a radio station Steve, that you certainly knew all about, but WMYU was a formative radio station. It was one of the first formatted alternative radio stations. And the person who put WMYU together, Sal Licurdo, Sal had a rule. If you can hear it anywhere else, if you can hear it on a commercial radio station, we don't need to play it. Now, somehow, I think I took that same idea. Gee, if it's already playing in a stadium, if it's already playing in an arena, I don't need to write about it. Unfortunately, I took that to another level, meaning I don't need to listen to it. Because of that, I missed out on a lot of genius things. Because the fact is, David Lee Roth era Van Halen is genius. The first Boston album is one of the best albums ever made, full stop. It needs to be talked about in the same way that people talk about Pet Sounds or Revolver or Nevermind the Bollocks. It's one of the greatest albums ever made. Now, I won't say I was too snobby to acknowledge that. It's more that, because I didn't pick and choose amongst the arena bands. Everything that was on it, when I was 22 years old, 18 years old, anything that was on an arena or stadium level, it just wasn't my language. I excluded it. Because of that, I missed a lot of important, not just good things, but important things, because Boston is important in the sense that, as I've always said, it is the last and greatest moment in the artisanal, and I'm probably mispronouncing that, Steve, artisanal rock movement, when the studio was used as an instrument.
Right.
When people used this studio mixing board as another musician. I missed a lot of important things. And I missed Hawkwind, who were in an arena band, but I still missed them. Mm-hmm. Hawkwind, who are now, when people ask me who are my all-time favorite bands, I say Hawkwind, Kraftwerk, The Beach Boys, and The Damned.
Right.
And Noi. Those are my favorite bands. But that's not to say, I'm not proud of the fact that I missed that. All that stuff, maybe it was appropriate. But yeah, I missed a lot of it. There are certain things I will never come around to. I will never come around to the Grateful Dead. I will never come around. Do I understand why other people like Grateful Dead? I don't understand how anyone likes ELP. Mm-hmm. Or Frank Zappa. Frank Zappa and ELP will always be mysteries to me. To me, because that's not music made. It's music made without a soul. Frank Zappa, to me, is the definition of music made without a soul. And it's interesting. It's possible that Frank Zappa's music was made for that very reason. It was made as soulless music. It was made to show what music would sound like if, you know, whatever. I'm going off on a tangent here. But my point is, you're right. I totally missed out on things in those days. I'm not proud of it. But my love for bands like Boston or Roth era Van Halen or Judas Priest or Blue Oyster Cult, who I am fanatical about, especially pre 1976 Blue Oyster Cult, their first three albums. I'm not so much ashamed that I missed it the first time around as happy that I got around to listening to it.
Right. So one last thing, kind of on the same, in the same ballpark here. As I was plowing through Only Want to Be With You, I read a post that someone had put up on Facebook with the quote from Henry Rollins in his book about about how hurt he was by what you had written about him.
I wrote a review for the Village Voice, I think in 1983. And I said something about Henry Rollins. Unfortunately, I don't have access to the review, so I don't remember what it was. Henry didn't like it. Henry took exception to it. Henry took exception to it enough that in his diaries, he said, I want to kill this person. Not in so many words, but real close to it. I think the word he said is in a book was, if I ever get him alone, he'll change, whatever. Henry did threaten me physically in his book, based on something I said about him. I don't think what I said about him was that bad. Probably, I wish I had access to the review. I do know that Henry is my least favorite Black Flag singer, at least the singers they had up to this time. I don't even know who sings for Black Flag now. I thought that Des Cadena was a much better singer for Black Flag. Henry is an interesting artist, probably more interesting than I appreciated at the time. I'm certain what I said about him wasn't that bad, but he took exception to it. And I guess because Henry is a cartoon character, because Henry is a public character, I probably didn't take seriously that he was actually going to kill me if he actually met me. Eventually in Los Angeles in 1993 or 92, a mutual friend said, hey, you guys should have lunch together and just shake hands and get it over with. And we did. And that was fine.
Okay. At any point when you were, you know, when you were writing about bands, did that ever come into your mind? I'm saying something. How is it going to affect the person I'm writing about?
No, but it should have. It should have. I think music critics should be more sensitive. First of all, at that time I was writing a lot. I was a weekly correspondent. I was the New York correspondent for one of the British magazines, Sounds, which no longer exists. As a correspondent, you have to write about things that you don't like. You have to cover things that you're going to be negative about. I'll tell you something. By and large, music critics should only be writing about things they love. They should be proselytizing. They should be telling people about things they need to hear, not being negative about things that they don't like. Because I'll tell you something I learned over the years. And Steve, I think you probably learned the same thing. Maybe you knew it all along. I learned something interesting. Whether you were Henry Rollins or Marquis Smith or John Bon Jovi or Lemmy or Darius Rucker or Garth Brooks or Steven Tyler or Morrissey, every one of these people, whether they were in a band you loved or in a band you hated, had something in common. The reason these people were in a band is because they fell in love with music. And I realized that John Bon Jovi, just like me, just like Peter Buck, just like Mark Bryan from Hootie and the Blowfish, John Bon Jovi was probably the kid in his high school class with the most interesting record collection. John Bon Jovi probably went to school every day and couldn't shut up telling people about the bands he loved. And that's something that almost everyone who was ever in a band had in common. There were the people in their high school class who loved music the most. And you know what? I should have respected that more. I should have respected the fact that if you are going to go to the trouble of forming a band, it's because you love music. Maybe in the post-American Idol era, in the post-streaming era, it's changed. I don't know. Maybe it has. But back in the day, Steve, when we were in the music industry in the 1980s and 90s, back in the day when we were playing in bands in the 1970s and 80s, you were in a band because you were in love with music. Maybe you were in love with music that someone else hated. Maybe you were in love with this person's music. You hated this person's music. But I'll tell you something. Whether you were Steve Vai or John Bon Jovi or Marquis Smith or Captain Sensible, the reason you formed a band is because you were in love with music. Now, I'll tell you something. As a journalist, I should have respected that more. I should have respected the fact. And it's interesting. I mentioned John Bon Jovi. I'm going on about this because it's actually kind of interesting. I mentioned John Bon Jovi on purpose because I think he's the person who made me realize this. I spent some time with him when I was working at MTV in the late 1980s. And I didn't especially like him as a person, but that didn't matter. I realized something about Jon Bon Jovi. Jon Bon Jovi was in love with Thin, formed this band Bon Jovi because he was in love with Thin Lizzy. Because Jon Bon Jovi wanted to form a band that was just like Thin Lizzy, that wrote songs like Phil Lynott wrote. Because it's an interesting thing about Bon Jovi. If you analyze what they do, everything they do is a rewrite of the Cowboy song by Thin Lizzy. Right? And I think at that moment in the late 1980s, I realized something. Everyone who's in a band is in a band because they're in love with music. They fell in love with music. Everyone you ever met in a band, Steve, every man, the guy who was probably the bass tech for whoever played bass with Alanis Morissette. The reason they were a bass tech is because they were the guy who went in there, showed up in high school, and they got on a bus and they couldn't shut up about the music they had heard the night before. And that's why they became a bass tech. And that is something we all had in common. And I wish I had respected that more. And it's something that I will still hear music now and say, I hate that so much, I have to write about that. But I don't do that very much anymore because I realized, especially in the era that we came of age in, Steve, is anyone who was involved in the music industry, anyone who was involved in a band, anyone who was involved even on the level of being a roadie or an accountant or a manager was doing that because they had fallen in love with music. And I want to respect that. Now, this is the last thing I'm going to say towards that. And this is something that I want to write about. I feel that as music critics need to be held accountable for the fact that they abused their position at a time when music critics had influence. Because there was a time in the late 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s when music critics actually had influence. They don't anymore, but there was a time when they did. And I thought about this. I thought about the fact that music critics for 40, 50 years meant something. All of that work we did, and all we did was prop up second-rate bar band musicians like Bruce Springsteen and the Replacements. We could have been doing something. We should have been writing about music that mattered, music that had political content, music that, and maybe they did, maybe the people who led to the, you know, who helped build up rap music or the Beastie Boys, maybe they were doing something that mattered. Most of the rock critics I knew, you know, we were rock critics all those years and all we have to show for it is Bruce Springsteen. That's ridiculous. So slightly different subject. But the point I want to sort of put a pin in is the fact that anybody, even the person in the band you hated, was a person in their high school class who was the most in love with music. And I want to respect that. And that goes back a little bit, bringing it full circle to Hootie and the Blowfish. Hootie and the Blowfish were music geeks. Hootie and the Blowfish were people who cared deeply about weird music. Weird meaning the music that other people of their generation, other people in their high school and colleges didn't care about. And that's what drew me to them. And it's what I think we all have in common, including you, Steve, and probably including a lot of the people that you worked with.
I hope that you enjoyed this episode of The Creationist. If you'd like to read Only Want to Be With You, you can find a link in the show notes to buy the book on Amazon.com. There's also a link there to Tim's author page on Rock and Roll Globe, where you can find his always entertaining and often controversial take on music and its intersection with our lives. If you haven't already, please rate and review The Creationist on your favorite podcast platform. You can also subscribe to the podcast to receive new episodes as soon as they're released. You can follow The Creationist podcast on Facebook or Instagram. The Creationist is mastered in post-production by Paul Ferrant. I'm Steve Waxman, and I created this podcast.